Mark, left a bit. Left a bit. There we go. So there's an absolute steal you find in this for under a fiver on eBay. Who'd have thought? The Morbius exhibit from Blackpool. Oh, Doc's going to be so pleased when he wakes up and says, shh, don't. Try not to wake him. Try not to wake him. Right, okay. There you go. Where should we put it? Right at the foot of the bed, shall we? Yep.
That'd be nice.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Love it. Yes, definitely. Okay, right. Okay. Can't remember to plug it in. Okay, right. Go.
I am still here. I can see nothing, feel nothing. You have locked me into hell for eternity.
Oh, what the hell's that?
Oh.
Got you, scamps. Mark, did you smell wet corduroy?
Oh.
Is it all got a towel? Oh, dear. Well, that might be a nice clip for the Blackpool Doctor Who exhibition people.
Yeah.
Right. Is it that time already? We better get downstairs, hadn't we, for the podcast. Come on. Ooh. Out. Ooh. Let me just change my gym gems. Day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 135 of the Diddly Dumb Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Aidan.
And I'm Mark.
And quite a few things have been going on since last we spoke. Hayden's had a birthday.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've actually aged during the watching of the show that we're going to be covering this week, so.
You're luckier than my sister, who had a birthday on Wednesday, and her town is completely had its postal deliveries cut off this week in Colchester.
Seriously?
She's only had what her sort of a lockdown household can give her.
Mm.
Poor thing. Mark, I've always been jealous of people who can draw. Mark sent not being able to find a JNT-themed birthday card, sketched one of his own, which we might put up on our Tumblr site, if Mark's agreeable to it.
Oh, yes.
I did have to explain who that caricature was, though, to my wife, who's that? Well, Sophie, this is a drawing of the producer of Doctor Who for 9 years in the 1980s.
Not at all nerdy.
It might have been simpler to just say, I have no idea.
I think it's Mark.
It's a totally tasteless caricature of himself.
The hardest bit was trying to draw a Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah, to do a Hawaiian shirt in black Bic pen was an incredible achievement, actually. That was very good.
You.
But no, I had a wonderful day, and thank you very much for your cards. That was to my co-presenters, not you listeners. I didn't get one from any of you.
Hang on, that was in Biro. Oh, sorry, I assumed it was in oil paint. Oh, I'm a bit disappointed now. Sorry, Hayden, what did you get? Did you get anything interesting?
Yeah, I did actually, thank you. Yeah, I got a couple of Doctor Who related presents. I mean, I mainly asked for books this time around from my Rels. And I got the Target novelisation of Rose by Russell T Davies, which I'm looking forward to reading because I mean, we revisited the Ninth Doctor era recently and it seemed to bring back an awful lot of happy memories for us all. So I'm hoping that reading the book will do the same for me. And I know he's put quite a lot of new stuff in there as well. So, you know, hinting at future Doctors and what have you in Clive's cut scene when he's... him and Rose are talking about, I think he's an alien. I think he's a being from another world and all that kind of thing. And then the other thing was, I'm getting sort of secondhand eBay books of the Marvel graphic novels collection.
Oh yes, you were chatting just about this the other night, weren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. I mean, I've got quite a few already, but there are some which were glaring omissions from my collection. One of them was Marvel's, which I thought was ace. The Death of the Stacys for The Amazing Spider-Man, which actually was really good. I thought with it being an older comic from the 60s, you tend to get with the older comics very stilted dialogue and very yeah. simplistic plot lines. And actually, I found that one rather effective. The next one I've got that I'm only about two issues into at the moment.
Hang on, stilted dialogue and simplistic plot lines. Will you stop slapping off this podcast, Hayden?
And the next one, which I'm currently a couple of issues into, is the Fantastic Four, The Coming of Galactus, which is another classic. It's Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. So this is proper Marvel from the back in the golden age of... Well, no, it'd be the Silver Age, wouldn't it, in the 60s of comics. And this is, of course, the front cover that inspired the artwork for the Target novelization of The Three Doctors.
Yes.
So instead of Galactus with his hands raining energy down upon the Fantastic Four, the Target novelization pretty much had the identical hands, which must have been traced, I reckon, of Omega firing the very same energy down upon the first three Doctors. So it was quite... I looked and I thought, oh, hang on, I've heard about this in the past. And I married the two images together and thought, ah, see what he's done there. I think that was an Achilleos one, wasn't it? Three Doctors, so...
Yes, it was.
My old mate, Chris.
Yeah, you old chum.
Me old chum.
Great mate. Don't like to talk about it.
No, don't like to talk about it much. My great mate, Chris Achilleos, but anyway.
Clang.
Mark.
Yes?
You've had some Blu-ray success today, haven't you?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Whee!
A little while ago, someone on Twitter, I mean, I'm sure it's not only my letter, that I presume the BBC got loads of them, but... emails, but I saw a couple of weeks ago somebody said try emailing this address to ask about the series 14 complete Blu-ray collection being reissued. They said if there's enough of us do it, then maybe they'll bow to consumer demand. So I did email them, and then yesterday I got a lovely email back.
It's because originally you missed season 14 set, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Mark, you didn't manage to get your order in quickly enough.
No. So I got a message back from BBC's DVD inquiry department saying, Dear Mark, thank you for contacting us. We now have some good news for you. A second edition of Doctor Who, the collection season 14 limited edition release will be available for pre-order on Amazon and HMV.com from Friday the 12th of June. We're always very sorry to hear dedicated Doctor Who fans such as yourself have been disappointed, and we have worked hard to bring some more product to the market. We do appreciate your patience while we work towards a solution. Best wishes, DVD Inquiry Line. Well, I just want to say thank you, Mr. Inquiry Line. I suffer fairly bad insomnia anyway, so from midnight onwards, it's Friday today, from midnight onwards, I... kept logging on to Amazon, kept logging on to HMV to see if it had turned up. And then I'd doze for maybe an hour. Then I'd wake up again, immediately grab my phone, check if it had turned up. And finally, at 7:27 this morning, I woke up, grabbed my phone, and there it was in HMV online. And so I pre-ordered it.
Hey.
If Mark hadn't had confirmation yet, we'd have kept quiet about this, listeners, so that none of you could get in the queue ahead of him.
So I was actually fairly worried that you'd miss out again, mate. Mm. That's why I contacted you on two social media platforms. Yes. Just to double check.
You missed season 12 as well, didn't you, Mark?
Oh, yes, I did. But I just want to say thank you to both Dave Kitchen and Mars Northcott, who both thought of me and messaged me about how to get a copy of the... Season 14 Blu-ray, so thank you.
Bless. What else has been happening? I learnt purely by accident yesterday that in April we lost Sean Arnold, the actor who those of you who go for the Midsummer Murders sort of thing will remember as Bergerac's boss in Bergerac. But those of you who had led the more sophisticated life of radio listeners in the 1980s will remember as Commander Telson in Earth Search. So that was quite a shock for me. We're locked down at the moment in the Whoseum, listeners, because there's quite a bit of disturbance going out on outside in Biscuit Factory Square. We've got the police barriers set up, but the townsfolk have come out in force because they heard a rumour that someone was going to tear down the statue that we've got in our town of a Confederate general. Slightly unusual, you might have thought, but they're saying that they're not going to allow it to be torn down. In fact, Mark, if you just open the window.
Yeah, hold on.
Let's see what stage the demo has reached outside. Sounds like the police have got that well under control.
Finally, bloody riffraff.
So what I say is, I've no truck with the Confederacy, but if you tear down these statues, well, how are you going to learn about musical theatre? Briefly on the subject of, shall we say, things which we might have approved of many years ago, but we don't these days. Got me thinking about our brief disquisition on the question of racism in talents of Wen Chiang in our last podcast, where we came up against this question that if something was common behaviour 40 years ago, God, does it become, if not necessarily excusable, then understandable? And during the lockdown, I've been reading the Bronowski book on Blake, Jacob Bronowski's book on William Blake and his poetry. And it brought to mind Bronowski's great TV series from 1973, The Ascent of Man, where he follows human development through the development of science. And obviously the title's a pun on Darwin's book, The Descent of Man. But it's very noticeable that where today you and I would say humanity, he says man or mankind.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it is quite jarring. I mean, much less so once you get used to
maybe
it.
Maybe he's saying this, yeah.
But the interesting thing is the quality of the series and the depth of the ideas he's putting across. I mean, this series is one of the greatest achievements of the BBC. Make it clear that it is simply social habit. You know, I think he was born around the turn of the century and not conscious misogyny. And while I wouldn't compare the dramatic quality of Talents of Wen Chiang to the story of humanity's journey through the development of science, the intrinsic value of what he's saying is so high that it becomes a case of, you know, just having to recognise, yes, the word's a bit old-fashioned, get past it, and learn what you can learn from a brilliant man. I mean, possibly the most famous bit of that series is where he visits Auschwitz, where he's talking fairly passionately about the need for scepticism to combat dogma. And he's from a Polish-Jewish family who was lucky enough to emigrate to Britain in the 20s. And so obviously we can imagine what would have happened to him and his family if they hadn't emigrated to Britain in the 20s. And he's at one point he quotes Oliver Cromwell's words about the importance of thinking that you might be mistaken. And you just knew, oh dear. I was checking up on this the other day on YouTube. If I scroll down to look at the comments on YouTube, admittedly in between all the people saying, oh, this is disgraceful, the Holocaust didn't actually happen, you know what YouTube's like. You eventually come across someone, you know, completely ignoring the fact that here's a man who's just lost his family to the Holocaust, talking about Auschwitz, and someone coming across just complaining that he was quoting from Oliver Cromwell. You just get a sense of proportion, people. Think carefully before you make moral judgments about people you don't know, living in a time you didn't know. Statue of someone who's a big slave trader and was responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of people. Yeah, tear it down. Someone who's uses an outdated word like man instead of humanity. You know, get over it.
Well, isn't there a line in Imagine where John Lennon says the brotherhood of man?
Oh, right, of course.
It's said that science will dehumanize people and turn them into numbers. That's false, tragically false. Look for yourself. This is the concentration camp and crematorium at Auschwitz. This is where people were turned into numbers. Into this pond were flushed the ashes of some 4 million people. And that was not done by gas. It was done by arrogance. It was done by dogma. It was done by ignorance. When people believe that they have absolute knowledge with no test in reality, this is how they behave. This is what men do when they aspire to the knowledge of gods. Science is a very human form of knowledge. We are always at the brink of the known. We always feel forward for what is to be hoped. Every judgment in science stands on the edge of error and is personal. Science is a tribute to what we can know, although we are fallible. In the end, the words were said by Oliver Cromwell, "I beseech you in the bowels of Christ, think it possible you may be mistaken."
And you will all know, of course, faithless listeners, that the Brotherhood of Man was a Eurovision winner in Mark and My Youth, wasn't it, Mark?
Yes, it certainly was.
Save your kisses for me. Save all your kisses for me. Bye-bye, baby, bye-bye.
Ba-ba-ba-da.
Oh, you knew it, didn't you? That was Hayden. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know that one.
See, quality echoes down the decades.
Actually, you say that. There were, in that band, there were two men and two women, so...
It's a brilliant book, actually. It's Jacob Bronowski's book on Blake.
When you said about Blake, I originally thought, oh, God, there's another...
No. You're thinking this was an episode-by-episode guide through the four series of Blake 7, did you?
I kind of did, actually. When
William Blake in the Age of Revolution. And it's a surprisingly lucid writing style he's got.
I noticed today that they've, on this subject, they've taken Fawlty Towers off a TV channel called UK TV. I don't think I've ever watched it. Did that used to be UK Gold or something?
Yeah, it's sort of the umbrella for a number of channels, basically, right, including Dave.
Right, I see. Well, they've taken Fawlty Towers off it.
Only one of them. I mean, it's the...
Oh, is it the Germans one?
It's the Don't Mention the War one, the Germans one. And so I think people tended to react thinking, oh, how outrageous they're doing this because he makes jokes about the war. But that's not the reason they're doing it. The reason they're doing it is because at another point in that episode, when Basil Fawlty's talking to the Major about whether he likes Germans a lot, the Major says, I don't like Germans, and then he uses the N-word.
Oh.
Which most, I think, the BBC edited out from most of its editions of this years ago.
Yes.
But UK TV didn't bother to.
So that Fawlty Towers episode was being shown unedited as late as probably, I think, 2000, because it was around a time where I was taping a lot off the telly, and I remember that scene at the time. Yeah. Well, I say at the time, about 1999, 2000, they showed that on BBC Two. In the DVD, which I've got upstairs, it's the unedited version and just comes with like a tiny sort of disclaimer on the back of the box set for that episode. And I think maybe in the inside, in the liner notes. And I was under the impression it was because of that scene. It wasn't because of the German bit.
No.
You know, it was because of that. And I think, okay, fine. You know, it's a streaming platform. you don't own the content on there,
mm.
especially if it's a free subscription like it is with UK TV yeah. Play. And if there is a scene in there that is offensive and okay, fair enough, take it out. Especially if it's not supposed to be there in the first instance, which is very much what this was. You know, this was an earlier... I read earlier that apparently it was in 2013, I think John Cleese basically rubber-stamped for future repeats to edit that scene out.
Yeah.
The thing I'm starting to feel a little uncomfortable with this is that, unfortunately, there's quite a lot of programmes which are quite recent in age.
Mm.
Where you did have a lot of this guy. I mean, Mighty Boosh, The League of Gentlemen, The In-Betweeners recently has been taken down as well.
I don't remember anything on The In-Betweeners.
Well, apparently The In-Betweeners has only been taken down due to copyright something or whatever, but it's very odd how it seems to have gone down in the same week all these have gone. Bo Select has been taken off all four.
Oh, no, what a shame.
Oh yeah, what a pity that is.
That surprised me because I've usually channels like UK TV are the ones who will usually edit quite mild language out, like bloody or bastard. The funniest one I ever saw of that is that when ITV seems to do it, they were screening Die Hard, the first one.
Oh yeah,
where Bruce Willis keeps using a four-syllable word that begins with mother. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And they decide to not to cut it out. When he says things like yippee-ki-yay. But they replace it with someone saying chemo-sabby.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And it's really weird. One, it's silly. And two, replace something that's rude with something which is actually a potential racist depiction of Native Americans.
Funny enough, bringing him up after his... performance on Radio 4 yesterday, but Harry Enfield did a sketch.
Oh, the Badfellas.
Kiss my knee, Muddy Funster. Mm.
Mm. Yes.
Fun, you earhole. Yeah, Badfellas, especially ruined for television. Yeah.
And now on BBC Two, Martin Scorsese's highly acclaimed Badfellas. Reviewers might like to know this film has been specially ruined for television.
Hey! Hey! Hey, Tony, how's things?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. How is your wife?
Why are you saying about my wife?
I ain't saying nothing about your wife.
You know my wife?
Hey, sure I know your wife.
Did you fun my wife?
Fun.
Your wife.
Fun.
My wife.
Did you fun
my wife?
I didn't fun your wife.
Did you
fun
my wife? Is that what you're saying?
Fun?
I'm funny.
Why? No, Tony. I didn't fun your wife. You just sucked my duck. And I ate a pucker.
Kiss my
knee, Muddy Funster. Wait, you call him Muddy Funster? You're talking bull mud.
Goddamn
cake sucker. Fun, you ear hole. You're full of
number two.
Suck my
lozenge.
You goddamn...
Nitwit.
I think we should really just understand that these things are from a more ignorant time. And I think just put disclaimers on these things if they are on a streaming platform. Edit them if needs be. Physical copies, you know, for people who actually want them, maybe leave them unedited, but put a disclaimer on them and just leave it at that. I'm getting slightly uncomfortable that they are... I don't want to use the word whitewashing history, but culturally they kind of are. And I just think, what are you going to learn from this? Apart from jump on a bandwagon and then everything will get sorted that way. I think it should be left there in a way to educate and say, well, you know, we don't do this anymore, but this is what it used to be like, you know.
Also, it's taking away attention from actual matters that really do need to be discussed, like BLM.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, the proper issues of racism. I mean, I know we need to know. Yes, there needs to be a massive overhaul, root and branch, so to speak. And I think a lot more people are becoming a lot more aware, which is a great thing. But also, we need to keep the bigger issues at the front, I think, and not get carried away with, oh, Little Britain's been taken off and stuff.
Mm.
I mean, you can still buy DVDs of Little Britain if you want to watch it. It's not been banned. Yeah. It's not like they've suddenly taken them all off the shelves and burnt
them.
You know, it's not been removed forever. It's just not on those streaming platforms, which is a corporate decision taken by a company who's decided that he doesn't want to offend people.
The thing that makes me feel uncomfortable about Little Britain was that was so recent that they were getting away with that. And to me, they just seemed to be getting away with it because they were popular. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
I mean, yeah. There is no excuse for Matt Lucas and David Walliams for blacking up and doing yellow face and as little as 10 years ago. That's insane. That's utterly insane that they were doing that. And it was at the time. You just thought, I can't believe they're getting away with it. And I don't buy the excuse, especially from Matt Lucas saying, oh, it was just us being greedy to show off what range we had. That's awful, that.
No, exactly. I couldn't believe it when I read that. Yeah.
Awful. Really, really bad. That's what shocks me.
Yeah, right. Better comedy.
Yeah. Every single sketch is the same sketch with them anyway. Off the first series, that show was already old.
What really disturbed me on that, I don't think I ever watched Come Fly With Me, but we've almost spent an hour already on this, so we'll edit it down heavily. Yeah. But I don't know, people might be more interested in this than probably will be than what we're going to go on to discuss today.
Yeah.
Was on Little Britain, they had a character called Anne, who was clearly from, shall we say, an institution for people with mental problems. And she would just go,
Oh, yeah.
And that used to deeply disturb me, that. And because I thought, it's not even funny.
Yeah.
Except that the is a catchphrase.
Yeah, my mum's late sister, who used to live with my grandparents, because she kind of never grew up, she was what I've always referred to throughout my life as mentally disabled. I don't actually know. I've never actually known what her medical condition was, but she couldn't speak. She could only make noises and rock backwards and forwards and stuff. And she was just a few years younger than my mum. So she passed away sort of probably in the 80s, I think. That's the thing, like Doc saying, is that... You know, literally, that's kind of all that my mum's sister could say, my auntie. You know, that's not really something to mock.
Yeah, and this is why I'm angry about David Walliams having such a successful career, and especially as a children's author. So when you're sitting down watching BBC One on a Friday night, you've got David Walliams acting as a woman, pissing in a pond, going, that's comedy, is it?
Mm.
The guy can fry for that, in my opinion.
How long ago was that? Was that the noughties or was it the 90s Little Britain started?
It was the noughties.
Yeah, about 2003 or 4, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually angry at myself that there were aspects of that show I used to like as a kid.
I used to laugh at it.
Well, it had Tom Baker on it, so, you know.
I think the trouble is I was of an age at that point. Well, if it came out 2003, I would have been 14. So it's one of those things where everyone's doing the catchphrases in the playground. Mm. But actually looking back now, it makes my blood boil at just how offensive a lot of those were. Yeah, and actually those two kind of got big, didn't they, on picking on people with mental illness and...
Mm.
And still are, surprisingly.
Yeah.
Well, someone like Jim Davidson.
Mm.
He's almost like persona non grata now, isn't he?
Quite right.
And I don't have no objection to that either, but...
No,
they seem to be, you know, that thing they had in the Grosvenor Hotel when there were all these businessmen molesting the waitresses. And he had a very sort of quite slimy excuse for that and just seemed to get away with it.
Wasn't he compare, like MC or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he's a man who's built a reputation. You know, he comes across as being fun and cuddly by pretending to be gay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's his shtick. He is most hated celebrity, that guy.
Yes, feel the hate.
Anyway.
Speaking of being outraged and offended, can I just say the other day, it was yesterday, and I wanted to have a quick word with Hayden. I just his door was slightly ajar, so I didn't knock. I just pushed it open. And what I saw therein had me reeling backwards, screaming and rubbing my eyeballs. No, it's fine. He wasn't watching the Black and White Minstrels, although he was... on his exercise bike in his Tom Baker underpants, trying to record his own Joe Wicks-style workout. But it wasn't that that upset me. What it was he was watching an episode of Doctor Who, broadcast in 4:3, in 16:9.
You're kidding me.
I know.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Delete it. Censor it. Cancel Hayden.
Yeah, you think you know someone, don't you?
I know. I just, honestly, I had to rush to the bathroom to be sick. Which is unfortunate because there isn't a toilet in there.
Well, on the subject of things which the BBC might want to pull from their archives and heavily edit it for a possibility that might cause deep offence to people. Today, faithless listeners, we're going to be talking about... It's a story which, in the Doctor Who Monthly's Mighty 200 poll in 2009, do we know where it came?
It better not have beaten Horns and Nymon.
Out of 200, it came 198th.
Oh, yes!
Bloody hell.
We are to start referring to the Sylvester McCoy debut story, Time and the Rani.
Yeah, whose idea was this?
It's mine, sorry.
I suggested, why don't we do something fun and light?
Do you want to try and guess what were the only two stories which came below this?
Twin Dilemma?
Yeah.
Not Fear Her.
Time Lash.
Oh, Time Lash.
So, first story of season 24. Written by Pip and Jane Baker.
Oh, the recently departed Pip.
Yes, of course, yeah. So we can say what we like about him.
Chris Chibnall did.
Directed by Andrew Morgan. Studio camera supervisor was Alec Wheel.
Yay!
Mark, I noticed too, we saw an exhibition on at Capitol 3, I think. It is the story of Time and the Rani. Mark? Will you put those spoons down, please?
No, this is... I'm just serving up some salad.
There's a lot of stuff that's was building up to this, isn't it? Which is the whole farrago of incompetence which led to Colin getting sacked. I think in mid-1986, Jonathan Powell and Michael Grade at the BBC tried to change Doctor Who. They even invited Sidney Newman to pitch ideas, didn't they?
Yes.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
For how the show's direction might go. I looked them up, actually. Having watched the Trial of a Time Lord season, Sidney Newman was unimpressed and in a memo dated October the 6th, 86, criticised it as largely socially valueless, escapist schlock. He argued the series should engage the concerns, fears and curiosity of young viewers, which is unusual given what goes on next. He suggested that the Doctor... You read this? He suggested that the Doctor be accompanied by a streetwise, trumpet-playing schoolgirl in John Lennon-type spectacles, brackets, right. Because she's stylish, brackets.
Nuts.
Her defining character trait would be that she plays the trumpet on unexpected occasions and is accompanied by her graffiti-spraying yobbo elder brother.
Right.
He was going to suggest bringing back Patrick Troughton. If we thought those ideas were crazy, he even then suggested the Doctor change into a woman.
What?!
What?
He'd passed away by this point, though, hadn't he?
Well, that explains why this didn't make any sense.
I think he passed away about a year or 2 years later after this.
Right, okay. Because I thought it was 87 he died. Because we did our two-part podcast on the 30th anniversary of his passing, didn't we?
Oh, it wasn't Michael Gray with a Ouija board then. In desperation.
John Nathan Turner, the producer, was told to fire Colin Baker, which he agreed to do because he expected to be leaving himself to move on to soaps, which I'm watching the extras on the DVD of this. I found quite, rather than sympathising with it, I thought, that serves you right. Because I got the impression that he wasn't that willing to fight to save Colin's job.
No.
Because he was going to be leaving himself. So he got rid of Colin and not prepared any scripts or script editor for the coming season. He came into the office. What, did he come back from holiday? So he was told, oh, you're still on Doctor Who, whether you like it or not.
I expect he was surprised and delighted, wasn't he?
So they got in a casting director to... Oh, you know, he went to see Sylvester McCoy at the National, didn't he? They got in a casting director and screen-tested a few people against Janet Fielding. Have you seen those screen tests?
Yes.
Oh, no, I haven't.
Yeah, they're bloody awful.
He'd already decided it was going to be Sylvester McCoy, wasn't it? So it was basically...
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Just ticking boxes, wasn't it?
I mean, he clearly decided JNT, hadn't he? It's going to be Sylvester McCoy.
Yeah, yeah. Because of the calibre of the actors he put him up against in those screen tests. I mean, the screen tests are awful. Apart from McCoy, who's, you know, very good. But that seemed to be a deliberate ploy on his account. It's funny because there seemed to be a lot of care and attention in trying to give this another go, wasn't there? Mm. After the hiatus debacle and after Colin being sacked. But I don't think a show's ever been so underprepared to be made and yet was still made and put out. It's shambolic. I mean, you know, you hear stories of back in the day, especially during the Hartnell and Troughton eras, where they're at one point they're filming an episode which is going to go out the very next week, you know, and scripts are a little bit hand-to-mouth. But you'd have thought 20 years on in the late 80s, you know, if this show wasn't ready, they would have put it back a month or two. I mean, what's the harm in that? It isn't like it's a continual, you know, on 45 weeks a year at that point.
No.
You know, there's absolutely no point in putting out something which is half-baked. And yet they still did. You know, you got no script editor on this, pretty much. Cartmell had been employed, hadn't he, by this point, but it was too late to make any changes. It's a shambles. And the really sad thing about it is that there are people on screen and obviously people behind the screen who are doing their utmost and doing their best with what they've been given. But what they've been given is just so underbaked.
Yeah.
It's like the eggs are still runny. You know, it's...
I prefer my eggs runny.
Yeah, but there's runny and then just plonked on your plate straight out of the shell, isn't there?
Yeah. There's runny, then there's salmonella poisoning.
And so they asked Pip and Jane Baker to write a story as Colin's final story, didn't they? This is originally going to be Colin as the Doctor and then regenerating into Sylvester at the end of Time and the Rani. Of course, this is season 24, wasn't it? This was the time when they cared so much about Doctor Who that they moved it to Mondays.
Yeah. Mm.
Which at least wasn't for like the following two series where they moved it to Wednesday evenings opposite Coronation Street, which is almost like it's guaranteeing that they were setting us up for a fall, wasn't it?
Yeah, they were, yeah. Yeah, the irony is it was still getting the viewers that the show probably would kill for now, though.
Yeah.
5 or 6 million, you know.
Who would like to start off?
I'd quite happily start off.
Right, in that case, Hayden, would you like to start?
No, go on, mate. The conch is yours.
But do feel free to jump in, because this isn't going to be like a wide-ranging... I think this is going to be more...
This isn't going to be easy.
I think this is going to be a bit more conversational, perhaps, than...
Okay.
It's going to be more Boris Johnson than Keir Starmer. or perhaps I should say it's going to be more Jeremy Corbyn than Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny with it. Obviously, this is an era which I think I usually preface most of my views of Sylvester McCoy and Colin Baker by saying that at the time I hated them. Well, hate's probably a bit of a strong word. I didn't enjoy it and I started drifting away from the programme. But then I was coming into my sort of mid to late teens at this point, I guess. So rewatching this episode, it's strange. It feels like a very alien era to me, because this isn't an era that I ever go back to. I watched about 10 minutes of it a few years ago, of this story, for research purposes, which I'll come to later on. I'd like to apologise, because I know there's people who are going to be listening who, for them, this may well be their story that they saw when they were, you know, 7 or 8 or 10 or whatever, or it may be their first. Yeah, I do apologise, because I know that every story is beloved of someone, and I know that, like I say, there'll be people who grew up with this story being their first, or the peak of their Doctor Who fandom in their youth, or perhaps the first video they saw, or the first DVD that they got bought. And I had to say to them, oh, that's very bad luck. I have to say, the very first, sort of, because he's got a cold opening, unusually.
Yeah.
And how cold is that cold opening? It's not good, is it?
It's served chilled,
yes,
isn't it?
It is. yeah. That terrible CGI. I mean, I can't think of where CGI... Obviously, it's cheaper than model work. See, I'm struggling to speak about it.
Well, yeah, the trouble with the CGI at this point, though, is that I can't remember if this was in one of the documentaries or I've heard it on another podcast, so forgive me, but...
Excuse me. You heard it on another what?
Oh, where's the fainting couch?
As long as it's not the first, second or third most popular podcast tape, I don't mind.
No, I mean, they were saying about how they wanted to bring in more computer-generated imagery to give the show a new look, but it's just at that point where the technology just isn't quite there yet.
No.
And I think that really does, that hampers it. It does hamper it.
When I was watching just on my first rewatch, like I say, since probably broadcast, this is the first time I've seen it all the way through. When I was watching that opening section with the terrible CGI TARDIS, well, I just remember shouting out to the rest of you, help, what is going on?
You did, yeah, you did.
And that arrangement of the theme tune, I love the fact that it's got the middle eight in it, but... Everything about it feels lightweight and cheap. It feels like it's all made of tin,
yes,
or something.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It doesn't feel...
Yeah. Do you know what? I mean, watching this, I've just finished my Tom Baker rewatch.
Mm.
That's at an end now. And
yeah,
this is... I mean, so this came out, what was it, September 87, Time of the Rani was broadcast.
Mm.
8 years earlier, you had the JNT era started,
yes,
with the Leisure Hive, right?
Mm.
This is a show that in 7 or 8 years looks exactly the same as it did in 1980.
Oh, I think it looks worse.
Well, actually, yeah. But, you know, it's still being filmed on videotape.
Mm.
It does look cheap. And actually, yeah, you're right. For that reason, because it's still being made the same, it looks cheaper than what it did in 1980. Because 1980, it was nearer to being cutting edge than it was in 1987.
Yeah.
And you think of in recent times, you know, in the last decade even, you know, during Matt Smith and Peter Capaldi and Jodie Whittaker time, how often the show has transformed itself, even within eras. And they didn't have the confidence to do that.
No.
It's like the biggest anticlimax, I think, in Doctor Who history is the opening model shot of Trial of the Time Lord.
Yeah.
Where you think, oh, bloody hell, this is, you know... I remember watching that for the first time, thinking, oh, this is going to be dark, this is going to be dingy. And it immediately cuts from that to the studio... So a very brightly lit studio,
yeah,
and it looks like Colin Baker's on the set of Wogan. It's crazy.
The Gallifrey Capitol is an Arndale centre.
it's like he's beamed onto Top of the Pops. You know, it's just it's garish, it's horrid.
Yeah.
And that's the trouble with this story, because there isn't anything in place for a new era to really give this show a real fresh impetus. It's the Colin Baker era still. And it's all that was wrong with the Colin Baker era.
But with a new logo.
But with a new logo, yeah. And with a new Doctor, obviously.
Yeah.
You'll probably gloat, Hayden, to hear that while watching this in the last few days, I started feeling guilty at having accused the Web of Fear being, you know, very, very visually gloomy.
Yeah.
I think Hayden's exactly right with his... When you look back to JNT's first season, season 18, you know, which is... In my opinion, an absolute cracker of a season. I think, on the whole, the quality is very
good. It's good.
Yeah,
it is good.
It strives for something more. I think I watched it as a kid, enjoyed it immensely. I think it works for adults as well. I think there's depth to bits of it. And I'd also say that kind of carries on to a certain degree into some of Peter Davison's episodes.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, we'll be talking about this soon, but I think there's some really interesting adult deep stuff going on in those first few seasons, and then it starts just this is Time of the Rani is a long way from season 18, and funny enough it's also a long way from season 26, it feels. Well, you said all at the start, it feels completely unprepared. It doesn't feel
It's 2 years away from season 26 and 100 years away, isn't it?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. But why would you, you know, not have the creative staff on board right from the off and all try and get on the same page? It's about like sending a ship on its maiden voyage without a captain. You just wouldn't, it wouldn't do it. No.
Yeah, and Andrew Cartmell wasn't properly installed at the time, was he?
No, they were filming, I think, from memory, I think they had days, if not a couple of weeks, before they were shooting, location filming for Time and the Rani. And that's just, that's ludicrous.
Hmm.
Absolutely ludicrous. It's a really stupid decision. And it's not JNT's fault, this. It's the BBC.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm.
You would not put a show... If you're really trying... And that's the real oxymoron here, is the fact that they seemed to be, you know, really trying to get Doctor Who back where it was. You know, bringing in the person who devised the show at the start to give them some ideas, to bring a new Doctor in because the characterisation of the last one hadn't been popular with the viewing public. I just think it's then just such a stupid decision to then put a show out and it's not ready. It's just not ready. So it then affects everything. So then everything here on in, the Sylvester McCoy era when I was a child in the 90s, barring one or two stories, was laughed upon. It was absolutely shunned. People hated it. It was seen as being the downturn. Sylvester McCoy himself has said in interviews as recent as a few years ago, oh, I was the man who killed Doctor Who. Well, that's, it's nonsense. That isn't at all. I think the blame does lie with the corporation. You know, they just did not give it the helping hand they should have done at all. And it ends up with a show that then takes, well, definitely 2 years to be very good again. But then it's a whole season. That season 24 is a bit like throwing ideas at a wall and seeing what sticks. Because there's just no time. No.
There's certainly nothing in there which you could think would justify the quick sacking of Colin, is there?
No, absolutely not. No.
But we've identified that maybe, I don't know, maybe Colin is the problem, or maybe Colin is not the problem, but there are enough other problems that we need a clean sweep of something. And then at least do something.
Yeah. It's like getting a new manager in for a crap team, isn't it? In that a lot of clubs do it when the actual problem is the board.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
And their buying strategy. And all they do is replace the figurehead, the manager.
Yeah.
Of course, with Mark being a West Ham fan, I might once have said, in a rather superior way, yes, poor Mark, he must have a lot of experience of that. But
as a Manchester fan.
Those at Old Trafford have to keep quiet about that sort of thing nowadays.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I just, it's such a shame because we know, you know, in hindsight, that McCoy gets a lot better.
Mm.
We know the show gets a lot better. We know the scripts get a lot better. There's more nuance there. It becomes a show which is thinking and innovating itself again, but it's just not there yet. I was interested, actually. I mean, I've not really had enough time to do this, but I was interested in maybe even watching Paradise Towers next and just seeing how the next story differs from this. Because I know there's always a hangover, isn't there, from Doctors taking over. There's always... That first story always feels a bit like it's a part of the previous era, like, you know, Robot for Tom and, you know, Peter Capaldi and with Matt Smith's era, Deep Breath. Feels like it's very much a part of Matt Smith's era, that. It's not really until the second story when it really starts to get going with some Doctors, so I'll be interested to see.
Yeah, actually, I'd be interested to see that. Maybe we should do that. I don't know, because I know a lot of people, because we mentioned 2000 AD earlier, and Andrew Cartmell famously says that with Paradise Towers, he was going for a very kind of 2000 AD style feel, wasn't he? And obviously, again, apologies, but this is Paradise Towers. This whole series is one that I just haven't revisited hardly since broadcast.
I am in...
Doc's not here to it's the idea of watching the second one.
No, I'm just when you mentioned, shall we do Paradise Towers next? I'm just going online and looking for package holidays.
Good luck with that.
In July 2014, this is in fact in our 16th podcast, we had Andrew Cartmell on as a guest. and we spoke to him about this sort of thing. And in preparation for this, I thought, I hadn't watched a fair bit of Sylvester's era for years. I thought, I better. So I know what I'm talking about when he comes on, you know, big name. I better watch it. And I liked it more than I thought I would on remembering it. I think I probably criticised its elements of it a bit too much.
Still he had a go at your writing, so, you know, fair's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, one all, I think, though.
But I just cannot... And yes, we know that there are people who are out there who absolutely love this particular era, but this, Paradise Towers, Delta and the Bannermen, Happiness Patrol, Greatest Show in the Galaxy, just do absolutely nothing for me.
Oh, I liked Happiness Patrol.
Otherwise known as the Brian Rogers Connection.
It was a lot better when we watched it recently than when I was a kid. I felt like I got it a lot more this time agreed. Around. But I know what you mean. Yeah, I've always had the feeling as well, Doc, actually, that I always got the sense that half of McCoy's era was ranged from excellent to good, and then the other half was fairly disposable. And that was pretty much all of season 26. Yeah. I'd put in the excellent to very good category with a couple of stories from season 25, and the rest of it I'd junk, which actually, funny enough, I did, because in preparation for this podcast, I'd sold most of my Sylvester McCoy era to a friend recently. I realised I didn't have time in the Rani anymore.
You bastard.
Funnily enough, that friend hasn't contacted me since he saw it, so, you know.
One of the strange things about our podcast is that because we're not necessarily all from the same generation, there would have been stories which some of us would have watched at the time and which others of us would have watched on, say, only on VHS or
DVD. Yeah, or UK Gold or something. Yeah.
At the same time, that's not just Hayden who's doing that. It was around about, it must have been... beginning of season 23, which was the Trial of the Time Lord season, I'd already been at university for a year. And in those days, we didn't have TVs. We didn't have laptops or anything. We'd have a TV room in halls of residence. And there's no way I was ever going to go in and say to them, oh, do you mind if we put Doctor Who on?
Yeah.
I had almost too much self-respect. And so, therefore, I never saw, from possibly Revelation of the Daleks onwards, I didn't see anything from Trial of the Time Lord through to Survival on its first broadcast. I might have caught the odd episode here and there, let's say if I'd gone home for the weekend or something.
Yeah.
But I mean, to the extent that when on the Tom Baker years, when he's talking about the Key to Time series...
Hmm. I think that the Key to Time idea, which went on right through the whole season, was a wonderful idea in the office, where they thought the whole season would cohere and build up to a tumultuous climax. I think that that doesn't really work. It has been tried once since.
And I remember watching that thinking, I don't remember them doing that.
Oh, really? So you completely missed the... Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I would have been vaguely aware there was this thing called... I'm not even sure if I was aware that there was a thing called Trial of the Time Lord then.
That's a fairly silly decision as well, to try and replicate what's currently going on for the show at the BBC on screen for a whole season as well. You do get the feeling that the Cartmel era works so well because JNT had basically stepped back, hadn't he?
Possibly.
Because when he was driving it creatively in the mid-80s, that was when the show was going to pop. You know, it absolutely was. Well, his decisions were...
Him and Eric Saywood as a partnership became quite toxic, didn't it? So,
yeah, exactly. And they both stayed too long. And I know he wasn't allowed to leave anything else and was pretty much signed into Doctor Who because they said, well, we're not going to give you anything else. So basically, you're not going to have a career here at the BBC if you... So, I completely understand that aspect of it. But the best thing that ever happened, really, for the show, I think, was... Well, under his tenure, as it were, was bringing Cartmel in and him stepping back creatively. You know, and just doing what he was good at, which was promotion. Yeah. He was very good at promotion, JNT, but with almost everything else, you know, once he'd sort of used those ideas in the first sort of 2 or 3 years as producer, he absolutely should have moved on.
That's the problem, isn't it? If you imagine if they'd, you know, when they were bringing back Doctor Who in 2005,
yeah.
So who should we have the showrunner? And they'd said, well, let's have Russell T. Davis. Oh, tell them about Russell T. Davis. Oh, well, he's very good at getting headlines in the tabloids about the programme.
Yeah.
You would think, you know, is he a skilled executive producer?
Yeah, yeah.
But the point I'm making about being at university is, so therefore, I wasn't a particularly great fan of Collins' era. So I would have read, say, in the newspapers, because don't forget, we didn't have any internet in those days.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, didn't have any mobile phones. If you wanted to phone home, you'd go down to the bottom of a stairwell to a payphone that's on the wall. Use what do they use? A phone card.
A phone card.
Yeah. Usually queuing up, waiting for people to get. It's amazing now.
Did you have a Doctor Who phone card? Because you did used to be able to get those, didn't you?
No, just one of those green ones. And so I would have heard it said in the papers. Oh, who's new Doctor? Oh, it's Sylvester McCoy. Isn't he the guy who just pulls the funny faces on Vision On and Tiz was? Who's the companion?
Yeah.
Oh, it's Bonnie Langford. I still haven't got over her appearance on the Russell Arty show.
Hello, everybody. My name's June. What's yours?
And so I would have been thinking, God, I bet this is rubbish. Despite the fact I wasn't watching it.
Yeah.
So I was already, shall we say, prejudiced against it.
Yes, same here.
Did you watch it at the time, Mark?
I watched some of it. I didn't watch all of it. I think I did watch most of Time the Rani on broadcast, but...
That explains a lot.
Yes. I'm not going to say what I was going to say. I did watch this story on broadcast, but then I think I drifted away and I just basically caught the odd episode here and there, and then a couple of years later or a few years later I'd be down the pub on the Doctor Who pinball and Sylvester McCoy and Colin Baker would be the last two doctors that I'd choose to be, because you could sort of choose which doctor you wanted. They were my least two favourite doctors. Colin would have been, I mean, they would have literally been sort of equal sixth, I think, possibly. Perhaps Colin. So I'm rambling a bit now, sorry, trying to think about this.
So I would have come across these, 92, 93, 94, say.
Right.
When I was sharing a house in North London with some mates. And they would have been on UK Gold as omnibus set episodes on Sunday mornings. When I was usually drifting in and out of sleep, watching them at the end of my bed.
Hungover.
And the quality of the tapes wasn't particularly good. And so I would have been thinking, oh, this is not something I'm particularly interested in. When did you first started seeing Sylvester's Era Hayden? Were you picking these randomly as you found VHSs in the library?
Yeah, it was incredibly ad hoc, because it very much was based upon what that library had in stock.
Mm.
And apart from the odd one which had been bought to me for Christmas presents or birthday presents. I mean, that's only one or two every year I was getting from my parents, so that wasn't much either. It was just what was returned. And the first Sylvester McCoy story I saw was Dragonfire. And I remember not being particularly keen on it, but seeing, again, pretty much what I see now, actually, seeing potential. I suppose, you know, seeing bits in there that I liked, but there was large swathes of it that I thought, not so sure about this. I have to say, the things which I didn't like on reflection are still the things I don't like, and they are the hang-ups from the Sixth Doctor's era. And that's not to say that because I don't like the Sixth Doctor's era, you know, again, there's bits of that I like, but it's the bits that it's glitz and it's Mel and it's the Doctor still being silly and slipping around on the ice continuously, and that incredible cliffhanger at the end of part one, which has never made sense, even in the non-edited part. I thought, what's he doing? But anyway, so I sort of saw that, and for a long time, I think that might be the only Sylvester. The next time I saw McCoy would have been a few years later, and it would have been Remembrance.
Okay.
I think because that was one of the first DVDs to come out, if I remember correctly.
With that terrible cover.
Yes, yeah, with the Dalek, grainy Dalek, wasn't it, on the front. That was like I was watching a completely different show. And I thought, actually, maybe this isn't all that bad then. You know, because even at that point, it was still the public consensus and the consensus of the fans. It felt to me that I was reading through DWM, which, because obviously the internet was in its infancy, there were only little bits I was seeing, was that the first five Doctors were really good and there's a lot of very good stuff in there. And then the sixth is basically a no-go because it was terrible. And then the seventh, oh, isn't it a shame because the show was just getting back to where it had been previously with that final season.
Mm-hmm.
But for a good 3 or 4 years there's a load of old tosh. Of course, that isn't the case. No. You know, there's always going to be things that you find in there which are good. But that was sort of how I felt. So then when I got to Remembrance, I thought, God, actually, yeah, no, this is actually pretty good. You know, actually, I really, really enjoy this. I think I'll go seek out more of the McCoy stuff. And then it was very hit and miss. And I've got to say, Time of the Rani was one of the last I came to, just before the copyright laws changed on YouTube. People were uploading Doctor Who stories in 10-minute segments.
Oh, yes.
That used to be the limit. They used to be the limit on YouTube. You can only have clips about up to 10 minutes on there. And I remember seeing Time of the Rani on there, and I just thought, oh, this is... I'm not even certain whether I got through it, to be fair, because it was awful. It was really, really bad.
I have to say, when I started watching this, and you know at the start when the TARDIS is shaking around and that exercise bike just falls over in the background?
Yeah, yeah.
I really empathised with that exercise bike.
Oh, how filthy was the TARDIS floor? I noticed this time.
Yeah.
They've got like size 10 workman's boots prints all over the floor from where obviously the lackeys and everyone have put the setup. And they haven't thought to wet wipe the floor or anything. You know?
I think what you see, that they mentioned on the commentary, I think that what that is, that's the Tetraps.
Oh.
Putting the big clogging feet all over it.
The whole production values, like I said, it just feels cheap and light. I feel bad to say it because I like Sylvester McCoy, but he's embarrassing at the start of this. And
yeah.
You see his first scenes and none of it has the weight of even the lightest moments of something like season 18. None of it has the quality. It almost doesn't feel like television. It feels more like an amateur stage play, or it feels like very cheap children's television. It actually feels like children's television. The performances feel like they could come straight off of children's television. They don't feel... I mean, I know people say, yes, it is a children's television show, but that's certainly not the way that you can approach most of the rest of the previous history of Doctor Who.
No.
Sylvester does get better. Even as these episodes go on, I think there's moments where he's quite good. There's that moment where he finally recognises Mel and he says, I've become more of a fool. And he looks absolutely crestfallen. And that's really nicely done. But that's because he suddenly starts going quieter and downplaying it.
Absolutely. Yes.
That you're completely different. Nothing like you were. Face, height, hair. Everything's changed.
Yes. And I've become more of a fool too, it seems, Mel. Doesn't bode well for my seventh persona.
Well, it is one of the reasons why that scene in Remembrance works.
Mm.
In the cafe.
You know, every great decision creates ripples.
Yeah,
because he's absolutely toned the thing down.
Can I help you?
A mug of tea, please.
Cold night tonight.
Yes, it is bitter, very bitter. Where's Harry?
Visiting his missus. She's in hospital.
Of course. Little bit wins.
Your tea? Sugar?
Ah, a decision. Would it make any difference?
Would make your tea sweet?
Yes, but beyond the confines of my taste buds, would it make any difference?
Not really.
But...
Yeah?
What if I could control people's taste buds? What if I decided that no one would take sugar? That'd make a difference to those who sell the sugar and those who cut the cane.
My father, he was a cane cutter.
Exactly. Now, if no one had used sugar, your father wouldn't have been a cane cutter.
If this sugar thing had never started, my great-grandfather wouldn't have been kidnapped, chained up, and sold in Kingston in the first place. I'd be an African.
See? Every great decision creates ripples. Like a huge boulder dropped in a lake. The ripples merge, rebound off the banks in unforeseeable ways. The heavier the decision, the larger the waves, the more uncertain the consequences.
Life's like that. Best thing is just to get on with it.
But it's funny because the whole... All of those sequences of that set must have been recorded first because I reckon they're the Seventh Doctor in his real infancy, where he's struggling to work out where...
He's just very young, isn't he?
But he's been given no guidance either. There's nothing here. You know how with Troughton, they consulted. It was him, it was Sidney Newman, it was Christopher Barry, and I think it was Innes Lloyd, were all meeting.
Oh, yeah, thank God they didn't go with Troughton blacking up.
Well, exactly. But they thought about, the captain idea, or wearing a Harpo Marx wig, all this kind of thing. They thought about this character. The one thing that improves in those initial scenes is when he gets the costume.
Yes.
And everything seems a lot calmer. Funnily enough, that set seems a lot calmer when Colin Baker's jacket isn't there. The whole thing settles down.
I think that's the thing about the cafes and the ripples in the sugar. Which I think is his best scene of his entire era. Because it's ironic that he's clearly, you look at all the pratfalls that are happening. The fact that when his first line is...
I must just pop over to Centre I-7 and then perhaps a quick holiday. Right, that all seems quite clear. Just three small points. Where am I? Who am I? And who are you?
And then he leaps up, spins round and points dramatically and says, and who are you? And then around, you can see he's... And he admits that his background is in physical acting and physical drama and physical comedy, all these pratfalls. And so he's jumping around that laboratory set. And that's what I think spoils a lot of it.
Yeah.
And especially given that he puts on that exaggerated voice. So your past is littered with a mutilated results of your unethical experiments.
Oh. Check it out, Mark. There's been a murder.
What? Well, I didn't know Sylvester McCoy was guesting. I'd have been a lot nicer.
And the silly rolling of the R's. But it's ironic that it's when he's still, physically still, and calm, like when he says about, I'm a fool, like when he's talking just gently to the cafe owner about ripples in time, like a few of the scenes in Fenric, where he's doing that. He's pretty good at it.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
If Sylvester McCoy got better once he got rid of Colin's coat, and in fact, everything started feeling better once Sylvester wasn't wearing that coat, should JNT and the BBC just have fired Colin's coat?
Well, you know what? I mean, that's not a bad idea, actually. Because I'm still of the church that I don't think Colin Baker he's not a bad actor.
Oh, no.
I don't think he's necessarily a bad doctor either. I just think circumstance and characterisation absolutely did him in. I mean, when the Blu-ray came out last year, I watched Trial of a Time Lord, and it's, completely. And he's fairly good in it. He's actually quite likable. Apart from the bits when he's, calling the Valyar the Knacker's Yard and all that rubbish, where that bluster comes back. Actually, in the stories, he's actually very good as the Doctor. But that costume is a problem. It's a big problem.
Also, it's the wordplay problem, because Colin Baker had it, and that was his shtick, wasn't it? Puns and the wordplay. That was his shtick. Yeah. And yet, then they start with a new Doctor, and what do they first do? Oh, I know. Let's make wordplay and puns and his
The mixed metaphors
and his,
yeah,
malapropisms.
He gets all the puns and proverbs wrong.
Yes. And also he, you know, delivers, you know, the way that Bond would deliver like a line, like say shocking and stuff and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, two or three times a film. Whereas it seems here that they're doing it every other sentence and it's just,
yeah,
it's just too much. Can we take a break for 5 minutes? Because I need the toilet and I could do with a fag if that's all right. Is this an opportune moment?
Mark, will you please be honest with us and put them in the order of importance to you?
Is that all right?
Be careful when you're multitasking, Mark.
Ice cream, or maybe some nuts, a cool glass of orange, why not try a hot dog? From the sales staff and in the foyer, now.
Will Doctor Who skate this time? Buy Wool's new shaped Sky Ray with double flavors of raspberry and orange. And you get a free color picture card, one of a series showing Doctor Who and the Space Raiders battling with Daleks. Free when you buy Wool's new shaped Sky Ray. Only 6 months.
May we remind you that for the convenience of those patrons who prefer not to smoke, seating areas on the right-hand side of this auditorium have been designated as no smoking areas. Your cooperation is appreciated.
Right, Mark, you were talking about we went from Colin, where his shtick was wordplay, to a new Doctor, where his shtick was also puns and wordplay.
Yes. Now, I think I kind of come to the end of that bit, really, which is why I called for a timeout.
I don't know about you, but they are mildly notorious having a slightly tin ear for words and dialogue, aren't they, Pip and Jane Baker?
Mm.
I know they say that they much preferred the writing they did in Mark of the Rani, but even that had stuff like an apposite epithet. But actually, as annoying as I thought all the Bad Workman Always Blooms His Fool stuff was going to be, if you actually look at them, some of them are quite clever.
Yes, every dogma has its day.
Yeah, absence makes the nose grow longer. Time and tide melts the snowman.
Hmm.
Which actually, it actually does, doesn't it? More hasta, less vista. Which I thought was very good. The proof of the pumpkins in the squeezing. Which it is. Well, maybe melons anyway. I was taught that if you pick up a melon in a supermarket, you gently squeeze it around the stalk. And if it's pliable, that means it's ready for eating. Having said that, you've got stuff like your past is littered with the mutilated results of your unethical experiments. Arcona saying, I mean, talk about show, don't tell. If I didn't need you as a hostage, you'd be dead.
Oh, yes, and Mel saying suddenly to Arcona, if Baeus is collaborating, he must be in the Tetrap headquarters, and that's where the Doctor will be. Eh? What?
And what about, in the aftermath of the explosion, helium-2 will fuse with the upper zones of the Lacertian atmosphere to form a shell of chronons. In the same millisecond that chronon shell is being formed, the hothouse effects of the gamma rays will cause the primate functions of the brain to go into chain reaction, multiplying until the gap between shell and planet is filled. What?
Well, I was just completely lost at that point, aren't you?
Yeah, you are. Yeah, because I actually, when he does that, that baby goes, oh, time manipulator. What? How have you got that from that? I can't even understand. You know, it's like, it's talk about talking over your audience. Mm. You know, you've completely overshot them. I don't want to slag them off, Pip and Jane Baker, but how do I say this?
All building up to the line, which is the first, I don't think I've ever seen episode 4 before. I have the Loy Hargill. Nothing can stop me now. It's a bit like, you know how Chris Chibnall has decided that the Gallifreyans are actually called Shibogans.
Mm.
Just because it's mentioned in Deadly Assassin, when actually, clearly, it seems to me in Deadly Assassin, Shroons is meant, it's not meant to be the name of their race.
No.
It's meant to be a sort of Gallifreyan word for like hooligans.
Yes.
Or yeah. Vandals.
Or an underclass.
Even if it, yeah, exactly. Or even if it wasn't, you'd think, have an ear for the sounds of words that you can't really call a grand, powerful, millions years old race, something like that.
Yeah.
And the same thing, yeah, Loihargil may be an anagram of Holy Grail, but it's a silly word.
And also, why? Because people often say, oh, isn't it clever that they put those anagrams yeah. in and stuff? What? Why is that clever? What is Arthurian about this story? I've been immersed in a lot of Arthurian literature for the last year or so, and I don't get it. I don't know what I'm missing here.
Also, I can't get over this. It sounds like Roy Castle. It sounds like...
Spider-Man, Spider-Man. Oh, no.
Don't worry, I won't be. Don't worry.
But their writing seems odd as well. There's that bit where I think Icona and Mel are watching the front of the base, and there's a tech trap stood there, and Icona says, oh, they must be contagious. What? Doesn't work, does it? Does it mean anything?
No. I think sometimes some... Okay, I'll come out of it. I feel a bit bad saying this, because obviously one of them passed away recently, but I don't think they're very good writers.
No, nor do I.
I really think that there's an essence of... I don't know.
I think I'd need to reacquaint myself with more of their work before I could say, but certainly on the evidence.
Well, they wrote episodes of Space 1999 and other Jerry Anderson works towards the end of his career as well, and they were always the ones I didn't enjoy so much. There's an... Okay, so I'm in a writers and artists group at work, and when we look over our work, we give constructive criticism back. And sometimes there may be something that someone's given to me, and I think, well, okay, yeah, what you've written there is good. It's very descriptive, and it's a very accurate way of getting across what you're trying to say, but it's completely overshooting the reader. You know, if I have to stop and think, oh, I'm going to have to look that word up because I don't know it, that's disrupting the flow of the story. You've got to simplify things a little bit, not make them stupid, not talk down to people. You've got to be on the level, I think. And that's exactly how I look at Pip and Jane Baker's stuff with Doctor Who. There's nothing you can do to prevent the catharsis of spurious morality. Oh, it sounds good, yeah, but what the hell does it mean? Yeah, those words are nice words, but, And like what you were saying here as well. It's trying too hard. There might be a good story in here somewhere. There might not be. I don't know. I just can't. Without it being attacked by a script editor, you know, and his red pen, we're never going to know. But I just feel as though it's completely overshooting. I don't know what this story is. I don't know what it's trying to be. And I understand they were working under, again, they were working under immense pressure here. And I'm sure they were. Well, they must have been doing something right, because they're writing for big productions like Doctor Who and for Gerry Anderson series. But I don't think they were suited to Doctor Who. They're not talking to the viewer.
No.
It's almost sort of, oh, aren't we clever? And that extends actually to the puns and proverbs and all of that. You know, yeah, some of them are okay. Don't fire them at me, though, at 16 of them in one episode. You know, maybe spread them out, or maybe only use one an episode or something. It's overkill. And I think it's a part of their detriment to their writing, and I don't think they're that good. And I certainly wouldn't have... JNT, by the looks of it, probably was at a loss at the end of 23, thinking, oh God, I need someone to write this script, because Robert Holmes has unfortunately passed away, and I don't have a script editor to write it. But why were Pip and Jane Baker his go-to writers at a point of crisis on two occasions? I don't get it. They're not... Even what they'd done before didn't display that they were capable enough to pull it off. And anyone would have struggled. Malcolm Hulk and Terence Dix openly struggled with the War Games because two scripts fell through, you know, and they had to do a 10-part story, but they still managed to somehow.
Well, that's clearly Pip and Jane's strength, isn't it? Because they can be called on at the last minute to churn out a script, which is what happened with the final part of the Trial of a Time Lord.
Yeah.
And it's obviously what happened here, that they were looking for anything to get the season going.
Mm. But that's all wrong.
Yes, yeah.
All wrong. You don't look for anything. You don't think, Rose isn't ready yet. The script isn't ready yet. Oh, but Fear Her by Matthew Graham is. So let's put that out as the first story. You want to give everything the strongest possible start you can have.
But like you say, blame the BBC because they just couldn't. Their hand was forced.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. But I then question the decision by JNT to give the first script of the Seventh Doctor's era to Pip and Jane Pat. I just don't get it. There's got to be someone there who's flipping heck. I mean, if the BBC had brought back Sidney Newman to fire off some ideas towards them, why not bring back someone a bit more capable? Terence Dix?
Yes, exactly.
What was he doing in 1987? If they had the humility to think, right, we need to go back to the person who conceived this idea in the first place to think up some new ideas of how we can go forward, they could have done that with the writing staff.
Although, don't forget, it was written to be Colin's last story, not Sylvester's first.
Yes.
Well, actually, yeah, okay, yeah. I suppose that's true. But then when that's not conceivable, it isn't like Jonathan Powell called up Colin Baker the day before Time and the Rani was being recorded and said,
no.
Oh yeah, by the way, do you just fancy just doing this one, then you go at the end of it? That wouldn't have happened. There's time where contingency could be put in place for things. I just don't, yeah, it's so poor. Everything surrounding the conception of this is so bad. The only thing I really like about it is the working title, which I discovered today when I was preparing the quiz for the end of this.
Can I guess what it is?
Is this going to be part of your quiz that you're doing?
I'm just checking the questions again.
Is it mentioned about 20 times during the episode?
Yeah. Oh, I haven't included it.
Is
so
it
yes,
Strange
we can
Matter?
Talk about, yeah. Strange Matter. That's a really intriguing title. I really like that.
I think they probably got rid of that because of the fact that they say Strange Matter about 20 times in the last episode.
You think, given that it's been written by Pip and Jane Baker, that Strange Material might have been a better...
Am I being unfair and cruel?
No, I don't think
that
you are.
Just then. Okay, good.
I mean, it's like one of those things, you know, you say, you'll get people saying, oh, I don't like this character on TV. And then they hurry to say, oh, it's not that I don't like the actor. It's the character. And you think, why are they making that clear? Do you think we would assume that you can't tell the two apart?
Mm, yeah.
But it is, you don't feel like saying, I think JNT comes across as a guy who would be really fun to know as a friend.
Yeah.
To, you know, be in the pub with, to have to go around his place for one of the barbecues they're always having in Brighton.
Yeah, as long as he doesn't bring his friend Gary.
Yes.
But in the same way that no one in their right mind would make me a tax inspector or Mark a taxi driver or choose Hayden as a husband, you wouldn't really make him a producer, I don't think. You hear people saying, when he was an assistant, what do they call it, a floor manager.
He was floor manager, yeah.
That he was really, really good. But, but I don't think we have to say. I mean, I feel, you know that Papers Open Air episode where you've got Chris Chibnall and his teenage mates? Now, I could just about say something like, I don't think much of Chris Chibnall's writing. I don't know how anyone could say that. Not only when he's sitting in front of you, but when it's being broadcast, and you just think...
Oh, yeah, I know, yeah.
Don't people realise? It's just unkind to say that sort of thing to someone's face. Yeah. And it's the same sort of thing. There's on the DVD extras, there's another episode of that open air series where...
Oh, I know the one you're on about.
Sylvester and Bonnie and JNT are in the studio. And Sylvester and Bonnie are on the sofa together.
Mm.
And Patty Caldwell is... Who I have to say just sounds so much like the name of a Coronation Street character, doesn't it? Is saying, oh, people are saying that your show is rubbish. And they're just, the two of them are sitting there, just looking extremely awkward. Why say that just to someone's face? Say to JNT, maybe, because he's the guy responsible for it all. It just seems.
No, it's absolutely true, and that is horrible. In fact, actually, I think the second open-air episode is worse, because this is someone who's just he's new in the role.
Yeah.
You don't say, it's horrid. Mm. It's really, really awkward. And it's the, I can see what JNT says about the whole, well, the memory cheats bit that he says just after that and what have you. Yeah, and obviously in hindsight, we all know how good McCoy ended up being later on. But this was just such a terrible start. One other thing I want to, well, a couple of other things I want to mention about the acting. I think Wanda Bentham's probably the best thing in it.
Yeah, Donald Pickering's not bad either.
Yeah, yeah, Captain Blade is pretty good too. But it's her emotion acting when she's crying through that makeup. Mm. I mean, I would have been as well, but adding a little the gravitas and a little bringing you back down to earth in what's a very bizarre story, that's a plus. Funnily enough, actually, I quite like the spinning balls of doom. I thought that was quite...
Oh, I love that. Quite like those. Definitely.
Yeah. Decent. And the explosions and when they hit into the quarry top. The location work is really good. And the model work is pretty decent too.
Yeah. I do like the rocket model shots. Especially the launching.
Yes. Yeah.
Really? Oh, dear.
well, look, I'm trying to find positives, Doc.
Yeah. Definitely do. And also, I'll give her credit here where it's due, but I think Bonnie Langford is doing the best she can in a show that I don't think she's very well suited to.
I think I'd agree there. I mean, some of her stuff is just the sort of... what was her character called? Violet?
Elizabeth Botts.
In Just William.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some of her character stuff is still slightly that stagey Violet Bot stuff.
Yeah.
A little ironic that Violet's catchphrase was, "I'll scream and I'll scream and I'll scream."
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And her screaming is terrible and some of it's awful. But there's other bits in it where she genuinely shows that she can properly act. I've forgotten what they are, but...
Actually, if you think about it, there are good things about this. The snow globes thing. Exploding snow globes is a good look.
Mm.
Yes, yeah.
The Mel impersonation idea is potentially a great idea. I think it works together.
Yeah, I think Kate Mara is actually pretty good at it as well.
She's also better Mel than Mel is.
Yes.
Yeah. The way she sort of stands there with her feet very close together, Bonnie does, which is almost like the way a dancer stands, isn't it? Having said all that, by the way, about you both agreeing with me, I could never criticise someone's professionalism to their face, Mark. I wonder if when you were 18, if you've been put on open air... facing JNT and asked to talk about the aspect ratio of this DVD, what you would have said.
Yeah, I think ASMR is fairly good, but I've never really been that big a fan of the Rani, to be fair.
No.
No, nor have I.
This is the other thing. This is where the writing hampers the character again, is the Doctor keeps saying, it's despicable evil. Oh, evil. It describes the Rani as evil several times. Well, no, Mark of the Rani, she's a scientist, okay, doing questionable experiments and things, but she's not evil. She's not explicitly evil, like, I don't know, maybe the Master might be. If anything, the Master keeps getting in the way in that story, and he's a nuisance. Yeah.
I think she's not bad in Mark of the Rani, where she's constantly being annoyed by the Master getting in the way.
Well, she's a scientist with questionable morals, but she's not evil. Not an evil character.
By this point, though, she's just become a camp villainess, hasn't she? I mean, to be honest, her entrance into the TARDIS is quite glorious. It gave me high hopes for this, that this might be a bit crap, but this could be a camp classic. That whole, leave the girl, it's the man I want, and everything. I thought, this could be fun, couldn't it?
Mm. But given that's immediately followed by a giant Muppet turning over the Doctor for the Wiggery generation.
Yeah. I have to say, after thinking it was going to be brilliant camp fun, I can only slightly misquote the Doctor towards the end of part one, where he says, "The more I know Time and the Rani, the less I like Time and the Rani."
Yeah.
It's just very, very 80s, everything about it.
Yeah.
That's even if you can get over the sex wink at the start.
Oh, something which annoyed me this time, and something which I've never noticed about the title sequence before, but after that wink, the music stops dead, doesn't it? For a second.
Oh, does it? I haven't noticed that.
Is that it goes tiddle-dum, boom, no, no, like that, and then you got the explosion of the rocks coming towards you. And
speaking of the music, so when I was first watching it, it's Keith McCulloch, isn't it?
Mm.
I think, oh, this is just too much. I don't like this at all. And then I think there was a moment early on in episode two where I'd sort of become acclimatized to it and almost started to enjoy it. And then looking through my notes, I can just see how the music keeps cropping up. And as we move through episodes three and four, more and more swear words are written next to it. By the end,
the music's awful.
It's completely overbearing, isn't it? I mean, there's little bits where somebody's like in a corridor or something looking round, and the music's like, da da da, da 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 da. And it's like, what the?
It's Murray Gold turned up to 11, isn't it?
Oh, God, yes.
What did we think of the Lycurtian's particular way of running across the landscape?
Well, I can only imagine how dangerous it was for the actors, because if you try running along an uneven landscape with your arms down by your side, you're usually going to face plant.
Especially with your palms facing outwards.
Go. Do it.
Isn't there a song about that? Run like a Lycurtian.
Very good.
The music's crap, and you can hear the tetraps say, run like a Lycurtian.
It's strange, isn't it? I mean, Kate Tamara almost acts, as she does with Anthony Ainley, actually, acts Sylvester off the screen. But when you consider that, you know, okay, she's been on Dynasty.
She left Dynasty to do this. She took a break from Dynasty to do this story.
But I couldn't entirely take her seriously because she was also famous for a series called Triangle, which was about a North Sea ferry during the journey between something like Harwich, Aberdeen and Rotterdam or something. And you thought, well, maybe if they make it, you know, sort of a gritty drama or something, but they actually tried to make it glamorous. So that every episode would open with the ferry coming across the grey North Sea, and there'd be a very voluptuous woman sunbathing on the top deck. And it's very, very strange. But not as strange as Sylvester in Vision On, I suppose. Who have we got here? So we've got Donald. I like Donald Pickering.
Yes. I recently saw him in an episode of The Avengers. I've been rewatching The Avengers with my housemate. We've got stuck on the Emma Peel era, and it's very hard to shift him, which is kind of understandable, but a bit frustrating. But we watched The Winged Avenger, which he's in.
He's also in Keys of Marinus and The Faceless Ones. He's also the Permanent Secretary at the Foreign Office in Yes, Prime Minister. And he'd make a brilliant Time Lord if they'd cast him as one. Wanda Ventham's good. She's Wanda Ventham was the Kazi's first wife in Carrying Out the Khyber.
Yeah.
She was in The Faceless Ones. Obviously, she's in the Image of the Fendal.
Yeah.
And here...
Space 1999, is it? Or UFO?
She was in Space 1999, I think.
And, of course, is the mother of...
Benedict!
Eggs Benedict Cumberbund.
I quite like Icona, although I find it hard to forgive Mark Greenstreet for being so good-looking. He was in a BBC series called Trainer, about training horses, wasn't it, about this time, which was the last TV project for Mark. Gerard Glaister.
Oh, of Secret Army in Colditz.
Yeah, producer, yeah. That's a little treat for Mark, a little treat for you, Hayden. In 1986, he auditioned for the part of James Bond in The Living Daylights.
No way. Did not know that. Wow.
A little treat for the oldest of us. He was also the great nephew of Sidney Greenstreet.
Oh, Peter Tuddenham as well.
Oh, yes. Was he playing the voices?
Yes, I believe so.
It's interesting that roundabouts our podcast 16, that when we had Andrew Cartmell on, he had just published, and that's how the Rev initially bumped into him at a convention. Because, in fact, I think it was the convention where he met you, Hayden.
Oh yeah,
the Rev from the Diddly Dumb podcast. He bumped into Andrew because Andrew was selling his book Script Doctor. And the Rev was getting one signed, and he got talking to him. He said, oh, which none of us would have dared to do, so we'd have to come on our podcast, and he did.
Previously on Diddly Dum.
Andrew Cartmell was there, you know.
Oh, right.
He was in our I think he was a nice man. Again, the talks were great. But then the autograph queue was... I thought it was very well run. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that because I've seen some people on the forum. I went on the forum to say what a nice time I had at the event and everything. Some people on the forum were complaining about the autograph queue.
Never.
I disagree. They were complaining about having to buy a product off the guests for them to sign. And somebody said... Nick Briggs, who was a surprise guest, he wasn't meant to be there, he just turned up. People said he'd been rude to them. And I thought he couldn't have been nicer to us. My mate had gone up to him and said, you know, you do Dalek voices, can you do Zippies? And he did. He indulged us and he did a Zippy impression. And he was very friendly and kind to us.
Which you didn't think to record?
Well, you know, it's this Star Trek struck thing, isn't it? You know, it was also where another surreal thing happened to me in this queue that Mike Tucker, marvellous chap, and he's selling these beautiful prints of some of his drawings. And I said, oh, can you sign it? He goes, yeah, who's it to? I said, the Rev. And the little Dwas official next to him went, the Rev? Off the Diddly Dum podcast? So, absolutely bizarre.
Wow.
So, yeah, I don't know what he said after that, because my brain sort of melted and went into sort of like Father Dougal.
That, of course, was former denizens of the Hoosium, Alno, the Rev and me, from our episode 13. And as many of you will know, because we've played it a few times, the little Dwas official that the Rev mentioned was none other than our own Hayden. Which is how Hayden ended up joining us.
Not so little now, are we?
No, exactly. Oh, yeah. And so we all read Script Doctor beforehand. It's like his diary of going through his years as script editor at Doctor Who. And
ooh.
I remember the best part of all of it is the chapter on Time and the Rani, where he's talking about working with Pip and Jane Baker.
Yeah.
And I remember it being laugh out loud funny. So I went to my bookshelf to reread that chapter and found that I put it somewhere, can't find it. So I got in touch with the Rev himself and got him to reread that chapter for me. And he's been in touch and spoken about... A lot of it's about how Pip and Jane Baker come across as Lord and Lady Whiteadder from Blackadder, which has been weird. And talks a lot about the... 1986 was the year of the big freeze. So it's good to have people like the Rev on hand to do our emergency research for us. So I really would recommend any of you who are interested in getting hold of Andrew Cartwell's book, Script Doctor. Don't try and get it on anything like Amazon, because I think it's out of print and you've got rare copies being charged for about £100 or something. Go to Milk Publishing, MIWK, where you can just get it for its usual price of about £11, I think. It's certainly very interesting.
Yes, in fact, I saw somebody asking him about that the other day on Twitter, and he said that they still have it in stock, and signed copies are available as well from the company directly.
So having had the Rev do a bit of research for us, I redoubled my efforts and found my original copy of the Script Doctor and read the opening chapters, which are effectively the recruitment of Sylvester and the two chapters covering Time and the Rani.
Hmm.
And it's both fascinating and hilarious. JNT comes across as someone who's got more of an ear for an apposite epithet than I might have thought. He calls Pip and Jane Baker the Baker Twins.
Mm.
Which I just find absolutely hilarious. Don't know why. It's not insulting or anything, but I think it just sums them up. When Andrew Cartmell tells him that he's been making changes to their script for Time and the Rani, I think JNT says, oh, the Baker Twins will be shitting conkers when they hear.
Lovely turn of phrase.
There's an extent to which we're not going to say too much because they're no longer with us, but...
And we've already insulted them terribly throughout this episode anyway, haven't
we? That's true. But there's a point at which Andrew takes them for a meal and he's pouring a glass of wine for Pip. He says, say when, Pip. And a few seconds later, Jane says, when? And I think, oh, that's interesting. If you were thinking that we're being unfair on the story, it's nothing to what Andrew says about it. I think when he goes to the press screening of Time of the Rani at the BFI, he describes it as a sluggish story limping across the screen. And prior to that, he says about Pip and Jay Baker. I couldn't begin to be honest with them about how hopeless I felt their script was. How could I allow a script like that to go out in a series with my name on it? So it's not just us.
Wow.
And so I think the good thing is that we know that Sylvester got better.
Yeah.
In this. I thought it was... It's this thing, you know, JNT is supposed to have met Colin at a party. I thought, he's nice. I'll cast him as Doctor Who. And then there seems to be this random, you know, almost as if... Because what I do think, however good he might be at publicising things, he's not some casting genius, JNT.
No, definitely not.
And suddenly
not.
To say, you know, snap his, yes, he'll be brilliant. And when he is as, shall we say, as a man of questionable taste as he is, I don't think we can rely on what appeals to him at showbiz parties.
No.
Is anyone got anything else to say?
No, that's fine.
Marks out of 10. Oh, marks out of 10.
I'm giving it a 2.
You know when Icona and Mel at the end do a mid-5?
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to a high-5. I'm not going to give it that. I shall give it. It was initially fun, but it tailed off. I think partway through episode 3, it completely lost my interest. And I suddenly had to scramble for my notes to check which episode I was on, which doesn't usually happen. I'll give it 2 as well, because I think it's one of the worst episodes I've seen.
I think I will actually give it a 3. It's not 4 times better than Children of Time. Well, 4 times 0 is 0, isn't it? So, okay, then. I think we'll start bringing things to a close.
Actually, guys, I haven't finished yet. I brought along a little something related to this episode, but it's through in the Whoseum.
Oh, right. A computer, could you open the exhibition hall main doors, please? Thank you. What have you brought, Matt?
Well, I've brought 2 items. Now, the story of these items is rather random. A friend of mine, a chap whose name I can only remember, well, I can only remember his first name. His name was Blair. He was in some kind of cheap rented office. I don't know what he did for a living. I remember at one time, one of my friends said he bought the rights to Slippery Sam. I never found out what Slippery Sam is. This would have been the very early noughties, I believe. And anyway, this chap was cleaning out his office one day and he said, oh, you're a Doctor Who fan, aren't you, Mark? I said, yeah, I am. He said, I was thinking of getting rid of these. Do you want to take them? And he handed me this box. And then he reached in and said, he took out like a little arm, I don't know what it was, some sort of bracelet, and said, I'm keeping this one because I believe it belonged to Leela. But here you are, here's a couple of guns from Doctor Who. And I was like, sorry? He said, they're guns from Doctor Who. And I looked in the box. I thought, well, I wonder what story these have come from. Because I hadn't, there were still big gaps in my recent viewing at that point, and my memory's like Swiss cheese anyway. So I was looking at them thinking, neither of those ring any bells, but if that bracelet is from Leela, then these must be from the 4th Doctor era. I thought, well, you know, how exciting. And so I took these 2 things away. I watched loads of Tom Baker, and I thought, I haven't seen it, my guns at all. And I thought, do you know what? I bet that bloke was an absolute blagger. So my guns just went up into the attic. And then one day I was reading a DWM, and there was a picture of Sylvester McCoy on the set of Time of the Rani. And in the background, I could see something that it triggered something in the back of my head. And I went, that looks familiar. I went scampering up into the attic, got this box down. And sure enough, inside the box was a tech trap gun.
Wow.
No.
And
let's have a look.
Yeah, okay. Slightly battered and with some of the silver tubes down the side missing.
OMG.
There it is. A tech trap gun.
Good God.
And also, funny enough, I noticed that there's markings on the main tech trap guns that the tech traps carry around. And that are seen on screen quite close, or relatively close up. They've got more markings on towards the end of the barrel. So I thought, oh, that's strange. I wonder what version this is. And then I saw this, and I believe, because this one's sort of heavier and looks less intricately made, I believe it's the one that Mel uses.
Oh, yeah.
To fire out at the tetrap at the end. Because it's actually more basic. And because it's got an explosion in the end, I believe it was like a dummy for putting explosions in.
Yeah.
So I think that's my gun, is the one that Mel shoots the tetrap with. And curiously, I have the other gun in here as well. Which, to be honest, this was both a blessing and a curse at the same time, because it was lovely to find out that these two guns, well, I'll show you the second one in a second, are from Doctor Who, actual props, after all. But it was a real curse to find out that they weren't from the Tom Baker era, and they were, in fact, from two of my least favourite stories, which is somewhat ironic, really. And the other one is from, it's a...
Oh, that's...
It's a small handheld crossbow, people at home. Anyway, it's a Kang crossbow from Paradise Towers.
Oh, right. Oh, wow.
So it's after all these years of being on the podcast, I've never actually mentioned to you that I've got two Doctor Who props, because I was saving them for a rainy day. And I thought, well, we've just done Time the Rani, and we possibly need cheering up. So let's bring them out. Yeah, so there we are. That's my contribution to the Hughesian, is a Kang crossbow. I can't tell which colour Kang.
Thank you very much.
And a tetrap gun, as used by Bonnie Langford.
Do you think we ought to have a special room now in the museum called the Armoury? Because we've got these. We've got Mark's Federation gun.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I think we should have a special sealed armoury, a black archive.
Because with all the rioting going on outside, we could do the defending ourselves. I mean, you heard about why they had to put barricades around one of the statues in the square, didn't you, outside?
Hmm.
It's because the mob from the Terry Nation estate solicitors came round in the night and tried to tear down the bronze equestrian statue of Ray Kuzik. Oh, that's lovely. We shall put that on display. We shall put pictures of it on our blog. This is probably on Tumblr. All show notes and illustrative links and pictures from what we've been talking about today can be found on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. Okay, Hayden, are we going to do the...
Yeah, just a light-hearted quick game for us to play before we turn in for the night. Yeah, this game's called Working Title.
Turn in for the night. You're too used to this. It's only 5 to 5.
Yeah, so this is just a very quick game of Working Title. So we're just fingers on buzzers, and guess what the eventual story title was for these, please, chaps. So,
okay, fire away. Oh, hang on, you get your buzzer there, Mark. Hang on, Mark, we can't get any buzzers. Let's just pass one of those guns, will you?
Okay, so number one, Beyond the Sun.
Is it inside the spaceship?
No. That goes over to Mark.
Oh, is it Edge of Is it Edge of Destruction?
No, it's not.
Oh, we're in the right era, aren't we?
You're very close, yeah.
Is it... What's the one that, well, introduced Mark Corey? I've gone, Mark.
Is it the Aztecs?
It's not, no.
Oh, bollocks.
What's the one that was the one-off that preceded Master Plan?
You mean Mission to the Unknown?
Yeah.
No.
Oh.
Do you know what? This is really annoying me, because I did know this once, but my memory has just completely gone to pot.
Are we giving up?
We'll move on, shall we?
Yeah.
It was the Daleks.
Oh!
So you were
mean
one
the mutants?
Or the mutants, yes.
Or the dead planet.
Or the dead planet, indeed. Okay, so number two. So no one got a point on that occasion. Nightfall.
Nightfall?
Yeah, these are all first to seventh Doctor stories, by the way.
Okay.
Nightfall.
Is that Nightfall with a K?
No.
Right, okay.
It could have been, though, and that's a...
I'm on the tapestries, Doc.
Well, I think I've singed Gary Downey's eyebrows.
You've given a whole new meaning to Peter Davison's pleasant open face. Go on then, Doc.
Survival?
Nope. Oh, Mark?
Battlefield.
It is indeed. Yes,
oh,
Nightfall.
Oh, well done.
I only got it because Doc just missed. It's like battleships.
Okay, number three, Day of Wrath. These aren't very easy, are they?
God, no.
The next one's a bit easier.
Oh, by the way, Shifty McGifty, and Slippery Sam, is, I think, a series of books by someone called Tracy Corduroy and Stephen Lenton.
Hang on, you're changing the subject here.
A pair of canine burglars?
Giving yourself time to Google yeah. what Day of Wrath was.
I've heard that quiz.
I'll tell you what, let's skip because we're taking too long on these. It's Four to Doomsday. That one. I'll give you some easier ones now. Okay, number four is The Horror of the Swamp. Oh, that's Doc.
Full Circle?
No. Oh, it's Mark.
It's The Power of Crawl.
It is indeed.
The Power of Crawl
is a serious thing.
Oh.
Okay, so that's two to Mark then. Next one, Facsimile. Mark again, he's on a roll here.
Oh, might be wrong. Android Invasion?
No, I'm afraid not. So, Doc.
Spear from Space?
Yep, so we're back to 2-1. Okay. The Chameleons. Mark.
The Faceless Ones.
Yes. That's Mark 3-1.
Alright.
I've only got three more after this. We might as well do them, I suppose.
Best of seven.
Okay. The Computers. Doc.
War Machines?
Yes, it is.
And I think you'll all agree, faithful sisters, that I answered that far too quickly for me to have Googled it.
That's fine. Okay,
the next one is Too Clever by Far.
Careful, Mark. You've hit the Caroline John Memorial Chandelier. Right, Mark, you can spend the rest of the month putting that chandelier back together again, please.
That's Mark.
The Two Doctors.
No.
Too Clever by Far.
I'll give you a clue.
Is it T-00-2?
I'll give you a clue, right? One of the recurring characters in this story that we've covered today, it's the other story that they are in. Mark.
Mark of the Rani.
It is indeed. That's 4-2 to Mark, but we'll do the last one anyway. The last one is One Girl and Her Dog.
Oh, sorry, Mark.
Nuts.
Canine Company.
It is indeed. There you go. 4-3 to Mark. Well played, everyone.
Congratulations, Mark. Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks, Doc.
Right. In that case, faith and sisters, we shall bid you adieu. God, we're on 2¾ hours. We shall bid you... Oh, minus 10 minutes for Mark's fag break. Oh, we usually have the 10 minutes for the clapping, don't we? Mm. Mark, they're still doing that up on my mum's road.
Oh, they're not here anymore. All done.
They've got a little WhatsApp group, and they all go out on. It was pouring down yesterday, or it was drizzling, and I think someone had said on this WhatsApp group, "Let's not bother because it's going to be wet and cold going out to our front gates."
Hmm.
And my mum messaged them back saying, "No, no, no. If we don't do it this time, we'll end up never doing it again." So they all put their anoraks on and went to the gate and clapped for 5 minutes.
No.
So I'm very proud.
Oh, well, do you know what? That's nice, though, because if you want to do it, and your community's doing it, then do it, because it's, especially in these times, because it gives you that sense of belonging and feeling like there's more people in the world. So I think that's fine.
Oh, for me, it was never really about the NHS. Well, obviously, it was for the NHS and carers, but it was mainly the thing I got out of it. It was just one of those rare... collective social acts where everyone gets together. I mean, neighbours weren't even talking to each other before the lockdown started.
Well, exactly. You know, it's doing stuff with your neighbours when you've never done stuff with your neighbours before. It was strange and lovely.
Oh, here come the Sons of Skaro. Dalek Skaros, have you brought with you the government's latest lockdown easement announcement?
Emergency regulations. Please do not dump bodies into the river.
Dalek Grey, there are anti-Dalek Force ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap!
Bye. Till next time.
Dalek Ray, Dalek Ray. They've reopened the zoos.
Bye-bye, everyone.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dumb Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumbpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dumb, on Twitter at diddly_dumb, or email us at diddlydumbpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dumb is liquid podcasting. Stick it in your ear, old sunshine.